From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're going to have to make sure that we fight for every single vote everywhere we go.
They all say it. Your vote counts. But will it be counted? We'll speak with the author of the New York Times Magazine cover story, Can You Count on Voting Machines? Then the Supreme Court hears arguments in a voting rights case that some say might be the most significant since Bush v. Gore, an Indiana law that could disenfranchise thousands of poor and minority voters. And finally, the candidates and climate change.
I would like to see a show of hands. How many of you believe global climate change is a serious threat and caused by human activity?
I'm not doing that. I'm not doing hand shows today.
No hand shows.
No hand shows.
I'm with Dana.
Those are the debates. On the five major Sunday morning talk shows, 2,075 questions have been posed to the presidential candidates. Guess how many mention global warming? Three. Just three. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A new study of the civilian death toll since the U.S. invasion of Iraq has put the number of Iraqi deaths at 151,000. The World Health Organization and the Iraqi government arrived at the figures from door-to-door surveys at nearly 10,000 homes. The figure is far lower than a 2006 Johns Hopkins University study that estimated 600,000 Iraqi deaths, despite the differences. Researchers concluded their findings still show, quote, a massive death toll in the wake of the 2003 invasion. The new study also dwarfs other estimates, including President Bush's estimate of 30,000 Iraqi deaths in December 2005. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the U.S. military has launched a massive bombing campaign on southern Baghdad. U.S. warplanes have dropped more than 40,000 pounds of bombs over the past 2 days. The U.S. says it's targeting al-Qaeda strongholds in the village of Arab Jabur. The bombing comes 2 days into a nationwide military offensive dubbed Phantom Phoenix. At least 9 U.S. troops have been killed in Diyala province since the campaign began. The only military officer charged in the Abu Ghraib abuse scandal has had his one conviction dismissed. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Jordan was cleared last year of allegations he personally abused prisoners and trained other soldiers convicted of mistreatment. He was found guilty on one count of disobeying command by speaking about the ongoing probe when he was ordered not to. But this week, Major General Richard Rowe dismissed that conviction. Jordan once faced up to 16 years in prison. The private military contractor Blackwater Worldwide is facing new allegations of unlawful activity in Iraq, this time for dropping a heavily restricted riot control gas on a crowded Baghdad checkpoint in May 2005. According to the New York Times, the release of the CS gas by a Blackwater helicopter, an armored vehicle, temporarily blinded drivers, pedestrians, and at least 10 American soldiers. Blackwater's already under scrutiny for a mass shooting in Baghdad that killed 17 Iraqis last September. Military witnesses say Blackwater personnel appeared to release the gas as a way to clear a traffic jam that was blocking their route. The gas is only authorized for use in dangerous situations. Its effects include burning and watering eyes, skin irritation, coughing and breathing difficulties, nausea and vomiting. Blackwater says it reported the incident to the U.S. Embassy and that the case was investigated, but U.S. officials could not confirm an investigation occurred. The Pentagon's announced it plans to propose sending an additional 3,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. More than 26,000 U.S. service members are currently deployed. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has been urging NATO allies to boost their troop commitments, but has failed to win any pledges for more troops. In Israel and the occupied territories, President Bush is in the West Bank today for talks with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Bush met with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert on Wednesday, the first of his 3-day trip. Speaking alongside Olmert in Jerusalem, Bush said he'll push Israel to remove scattered settlement outposts, but reiterated his endorsement of Israel's plan to retain its large West Bank settlement blocks.
He understands he has an obligation to protect Israel. He also understands that, he's got to be circumspect and reasonable about how he does it so that innocent people don't suffer. He just gave you the answer on the settlements. In terms of outposts, yeah, they ought to go. Look, I mean, we've been talking about it for 4 years. The agreement was get rid of outposts, illegal outposts, and they ought to go.
Palestinian negotiators have called the settlement blocks the main obstacle to peace. Meanwhile, President Bush also continued to criticize Iran for a naval confrontation between Iranian and U.S. boats this week.
Ships were moving along very peacefully off the Iranian border in territorial waters, international waters. And Iranian boats came out and were very provocative, and it was a dangerous gesture on their part. We have made it clear publicly, and they know our position.
Iran has accused the U.S. of faking video footage showing Iranian speedboats approaching the U.S. warships. The former CIA official who ordered the destruction of videotapes documenting prisoner interrogations has reportedly said he won't testify before Congress without a grant of immunity. Jose Rodriguez was head of the CIA's clandestine service when he ordered the tapes' destruction in November 2005. He was subpoenaed last month. Newly declassified documents have provided more evidence the Johnson administration faked the Gulf of Tonkin incident to escalate the Vietnam War. The alleged 1964 attack on U.S. warships by North Vietnamese was used as a pretext to increase bombing and troop deployments in Vietnam. But a report from the National Security Agency concludes, quote, no attack happened that night. Cuba is marking the 59th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution, the victorious uprising against the U.S.-backed Batista dictatorship. Thousands of people gathered in Havana at a rally organized by the Union of Communist Youths.
Today, we strongly reaffirm more than ever, Viva Fidel, Viva Raúl, Viva the Fatherland.
Cuban President Fidel Castro was absent from the celebrations as he continues to be sidelined by illness. In campaign news, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson is reportedly set to announce today he's withdrawing from the Democratic presidential race. Richardson placed fourth in back-to-back contests in Iowa and New Hampshire. Meanwhile, candidates were back on the campaign trail on Wednesday, one day after Senator Hillary Clinton and Senator John McCain won in New Hampshire. Speaking on NBC's Today Show, Clinton talked about her widely reported display of emotion when she was asked about the personal toll of running a campaign.
I don't get up every morning to go out and make a great speech or shake a million hands and then go to bed at night and say, good for you. I go out to say, what can I do for you? How can we make our country what it should be? And when the woman said to me, well, how do you do that? I really felt touched by that. And I think we did connect at a very, personal level.
Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Barack Obama vowed to rebound from his second-place finish in New Hampshire as the Democratic primaries move on to South Carolina, Michigan, and Nevada. Obama spoke at a rally in New Jersey.
My voice is a little hoarse. My eyes are a little bleary. My back is a little sore. But my spirit is strong. And I am ready to bring about change in America. How about you?
Barack Obama has gotten the endorsement of the Culinary Workers Union in Nevada. It's got over 60,000 members. Here in New York, a new principal has been hired at the city's first public Arabic language school 5 months after its founding principal was forced to resign. Ali Reichert began her new term as Khalil Gibran International Academy in Brooklyn on Wednesday. Her predecessor, Debbie Almentazer, was forced to resign shortly before the school opened after she was quoted explaining that the word intifada literally means shaking off in Arabic. Almentazer was criticized for failing to denounce the use of the word intifada on T-shirts. She's filed a federal lawsuit against New York over her dismissal. And in Chicago, the city councils voted to approve a nearly $20 million settlement to four former death row prisoners who gave false confessions after being tortured by Chicago police. The four men are all African American. They sued former Chicago Police Commander John Burge and more than 20 officers who worked with him, alleging that they were coerced into falsely confessing to murder. In 2006, special prosecutors released a long-awaited report stating there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Burge and four other former officers abused suspects to extract confessions in the 1980s. Charges have never been filed against Berg. He was fired in 1993, still receiving a yearly police pension. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Juan, before we move on with our first story, you did a piece in the New York Daily News yesterday about the FBI. Can you talk about it?
Yes. Well, I reported that there are now subpoenas that have been issued by the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Brooklyn for a grand jury hearing that begins a grand jury hearing tomorrow to three young Puerto Ricans here in New York City. And supposedly the reports out of Puerto Rico, out of the press in Puerto Rico, is that these subpoenas are connected to an ongoing investigation having to do with the Macheteros, the Puerto Rican guerrilla organization that has been operating for more than 20 years. There's apparently a new investigation going on. But many of these young people and young professionals, most of them have no connection. A couple have been connected to the Vieques movement to get the Navy out of Vieques.
To
stop the bombing of Vieques. But at least one of them has no connection to any kind of political involvement. And there are great fears. I talked to Congressman Jose Serrano this week, who actually was the one who got all the FBI documents from the 30-year campaign of the FBI suppression of the independence movement. There's fears that the grand juries are being used once again to intimidate the independence movement and to try to extract information from activists or dissidents, really, not people who are engaged in illegal activity. But there's been very little coverage. I know we've mentioned it on Democracy Now!, but there's been very little coverage of these of this grand jury investigation. And I talked to both the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, but of course they are not refusing to comment or even confirm that an investigation is going on.
You begin your piece, FBI on Fishy Fishing Expedition, by saying a few days before Christmas, two men walked into Julio Pabon's sports memorabilia store. Julio?
Well, Julio Pabon is a businessman in the Bronx. Many years ago, more than three decades ago, he was an activist in the Puerto Rican independence movement. But his son, they weren't looking for Julio, the father, who is now basically a businessman. They were looking for his son, who's a Wesleyan University graduate and an aspiring filmmaker. And it was the son who they wanted to bring before, to actually slap with a subpoena. The son didn't know what it was about, but when he went to meet with two FBI agents and a member of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, he then was slapped with a subpoena and told to appear tomorrow in Brooklyn Federal Court.
How powerful is the independence movement? And the Macheteros, can you explain who they are?
Well, the Macheteros have been the group that has been around for more than 20 years. They were most famous for the 1983 Wells Fargo robbery that occurred in West Hartford, Connecticut. And of course, their leader, the 70-year-old Filiberto Ojeda Rios, was killed by the FBI 2 years ago when they surrounded his farmhouse in Puerto Rico. There was a shootout. He was wounded initially, but then for more than 18 hours, federal agents did not move in on the farmhouse, and he bled to death. And that has been a continuing controversy in Puerto Rico. The Puerto Rico government, which was not aware of this attack by the FBI, is now in a lawsuit against the FBI, trying to get information on what happened, who were the agents involved. And this lawsuit is now actually—it's before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has to decide whether it will hear the lawsuit, a direct conflict between the government of Puerto Rico, the Justice Department of Puerto Rico, and the FBI that is continuing to escalate. And even those people who are not supporters of independence in Puerto Rico feel that this is another example of how the U.S. government totally ignores the needs and the wishes of the people of Puerto Rico or their government.
Well, we will certainly continue to follow this story. Now we're moving on to election news. Juan?
Yes. Well, the Supreme Court heard arguments Wednesday on a case that many describe as the most important voting rights case since the decision that sealed the 2000 presidential election. It's over a challenge to a 2005 law in Indiana that requires voters to show government-issued photo identification when voting. Majority of the judges Wednesday seem to be in favor of upholding the Indiana law. A final decision is expected in late June. The law was backed by Republicans as a means to prevent voter fraud. But opponents of the law, including a wide array of civil rights groups, as well as the Democratic Party, say the law is excessively restrictive and unconstitutional. They argue that over 40,000 Indiana residents could be deprived of the right to vote because they do not have photo identification. Most of them are elderly, non-white, and poor.
Justin Levitt is counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. The Brennan Center was among the many groups that filed briefs with the court opposing the law. Justin Levitt focuses on voting rights and was at the Supreme Court hearing on Wednesday, joining us here in our Firehouse studio. Welcome, Justin. What happened yesterday? Tell us what this law is all about.
The law is one of a new series of proposals, and one of the very few that got passed in Indiana in 2005, requiring certain types of photo identification to vote. The main controversy over the law is that it's actually been shown to shut citizens out of the process, but it hasn't been shown to correct any problem that Indiana or any other state really had ever experienced. And the fight now is about not only thousands of Indiana voters who might or might not have the ability to vote in 2008 and beyond, but also about the standards for the rest of the country, how states decide which eligible citizens they're able to shut out of the process and which eligible citizens they're able to allow to vote.
And how does this compare to some of the other voter identification laws that have been passed, for instance, in Georgia and some of the other states around the country?
Indiana's law is the strictest in the country. It requires certain types of government-issued photo ID with an expiration date. And part of the problems with this is not only that there are a subsegment of people who don't have the ID, but that it's very difficult to get the necessary ID if you don't start out with the ID to begin with.
What's the ID?
The ID is, it can be either a state-issued driver's license, it can be a U.S. passport, anything issued by the federal government or by the state of Indiana itself that is current with an expiration and a photo on it.
Expiration date and photo.
Expiration date and photo, and for some residents, there's another hitch. It has to have a name that conforms to the name on the registration rolls. If you've recently gotten married or you've been listed on the registration rolls in some other way, your ID may not match that, even though it does show, in fact, that you are who you say you are.
Now, it's always dangerous to read the tea leaves in terms of a Supreme Court hearing, but your sense of how the justices were responding to both sides and whether they appeared to be leaning one way or another on this issue?
There were certainly some tough questions of both sides, and one of the refreshing aspects is that the justices showed a focus on the facts, really getting down to how many people had been shown to have been injured, focusing in part on studies done before elections took place and in part on the experience that Indiana's had since elections took place. They also focused on the damage that the law was ostensibly intended to prevent, the incidence of voter fraud, of impersonating people at the polls. I say that's refreshing because the courts that have dealt with the case thus far have really operated on the basis of assumptions, and the Supreme Court looked very much like they wanted to get back down to what had actually happened.
Justin Levitt was at the Supreme Court yesterday when this case was argued. Who are the people who pushed it through the Indiana legislature? What were the forces involved?
This law, as you mentioned, in 2005 was passed. It was passed along very strict partisan lines, which is something we've seen for similar photo ID or restrictive identification requirements across the country. It tends to be the case, although it's by no means exclusive, that Republicans tend to support this sort of legislation and the Democrats tend to oppose it. And that was certainly at play yesterday in the Supreme Court.
Could this determine the 2008 election?
This case could certainly impact not only votes in Indiana, but a wave of legislation across the country. We know that there's been interest in various restrictions on who can vote, on which eligible citizens can show up to the polls and cast a valid ballot. And what we're more worried about is that the Supreme Court will ratify a standard that says that states can restrict the rights of eligible citizens based on a hypothetical fear or a fear that really hasn't shown to be active in the state we're talking about. So the stakes for this case aren't merely for Indiana, but really setting the standard for election laws across the country.
And of course, we're dealing with a court that back in 2000 in Bush v. Gore decided that there is no
or make clear there is no constitutional right to vote. And although, of course, it's changed in terms of some of its members, it's actually become more conservative, not less, since then.
It has become more conservative. In some ways, that's actually helpful, because there are some who are very focused on the First Amendment and focused on the constitutional origins, the right preservative of all rights is what they call it, and making sure that any restrictions on the right to vote are amply justified. That said, there's certainly a lot of controversy. Courts thus far have generally tended to split along partisan lines. And we would expect, we hope, the argument yesterday showed some promising signs that this case will once again return back to the facts. That would be a very welcome departure. Supreme Court's got more time to consider this than they had in 2000. We hope they use that wisely.
I'm looking at Jeffrey Toobin's piece in The New Yorker magazine. He quotes Terrence Evans, the dissenting court of appeals judge in the Indiana case, saying, "Let's not beat around the bush. The Indiana voter photo ID law is a not too thinly veiled attempt to discourage election day turnout by certain folks believed to skew Democratic. He's not the only one to notice the three federal judges who approved the Indiana law were appointed by a Republican president. The lone dissenter was appointed by a Democrat. It was also Republican-dominated legislatures that produced the Indiana and Georgia laws, both of which were signed by Republican governors."
These things do, as you've noted, tend to break down along partisan lines, and that maybe there are two different reasons that people have proposed for this. One, there are some certainly who honestly, mistakenly, but honestly believe that this sort of legislation is necessary to correct a real problem we have. And there's very little you can do on the facts to shake them out of this belief. It's like a belief in Tinkerbell. There are another set of folks who look for a more procedural, more partisan strategic advantage. Royal Massey, the former political director of the Republican Party of Texas, crystallized this very nicely in a controversy last year over voter ID in Texas, bitterly, bitterly fought. And what he said was, look, there are some who take this as an article of faith, that voter fraud is costing us elections. I don't believe that, but I do know that requiring photo ID at the polls could cost 3% of legitimate Democratic voters. Now, I don't personally care what party you're in. If you have a policy that restricts legitimate voters, real voters who are going to the polls and eligible, and it doesn't solve any problem that we actually have, that's not a policy that belongs in our system.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Justin Levitt, for joining us, counsel in the Brennan Center's Democracy Program at New York University. It works on election law and voting rights. Thanks for joining us. This is Democracy Now. Well, when we come back, we'll talk about, does your vote count? Who's counting the vote? Will your vote be counted on Election Day? Stay with us. This business is killing me. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 650 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take in transcript and audio form, over 150 stations. options are. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, the 2008 presidential race is in full swing, and political analysts say it's shaping up to be the most open contest in 80 years. Wins by Senators Hillary Clinton and John McCain in New Hampshire have set the stage for a toe-to-toe battle for the party's nominations. With less than a month before Super Tuesday, every vote counts. But will every vote actually be counted? One by one, states across the country are finding critical flaws in the accuracy and security of electronic voting machines. Last spring, California and Florida decided to get rid of their electronic voting machines. In December, Colorado decertified about half of its touch screen devices. In Ohio, Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner undertook an extensive review of electronic voting machines that concluded their use, quote, may jeopardize the integrity of the voting process. On Capitol Hill, two senators have sponsored a bill that would ban the use of touchscreen machines across the country by 2012.
Last week, the cover story of the New York Times Magazine was called Can You Count on Voting Machines? The nearly 8,000-word article takes an in-depth look at electronic voting machines in states across the country. Clive Thompson is the contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine who wrote the piece, joining us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now, Clive.
Good to be here.
Begin where you began your piece. These stories, these anecdotes around the country.
Sure. Well, what I was looking at was the performance of touchscreen machines in a bunch of key states, Ohio, Florida, swing states. And what I discovered when I went and observed them in action is that they have a well-known propensity to sort of about 10% of the time have some sort of a failure rate. So when I was in Cuyahoga County, the day of the election,
In Ohio,
that's right, Cleveland, they have a touchscreen machine and it has a little paper attachment.
Sort of explain almost, what a touchscreen machine is.
A touchscreen machine is basically, you walk up to it and it's almost as if there's a large flat screen, just like a computer screen. When you vote, you touch the screen.
Like an ATM machine.
So you'll see the names, you'll see the candidates like that, you'll touch the screen, and then it's supposed to be recorded on the computer chips inside. Some of the machines also have a paper trail attached. They're sort of almost like imagine a cash register roll. You can't actually take it with you, but what you're supposed to do is after you vote, you look down at the paper and it sort of prints up what your vote is so you can verify with your own eyes that it's recording your vote correctly. In the case of Ohio, interestingly, that paper trail is legally the vote. What's on the computer chip is just a convenient way to tally the vote quickly. But in the event of a recount, they go back and they uncork the paper and they recount the paper trail. But the interesting thing in Cleveland is that with these machines, about 20% of the time, the paper trail jams and doesn't print for some reason. Now, maybe only one or two of the votes, maybe all the votes. And they've had this problem over and over again. In November, they had about 10 very close elections. And when they went back and pulled the paper out to do a recount, they discovered that 20% of the time, there was at least one or maybe many errors with the paper trail. So effectively, the votes are gone on paper, and you have to trust what's on the computer chip.
Well, I think that's, to me, was one of the most astonishing parts of your piece, because it's almost like the second generation of defenders of computerized voting have said, well, if you produce a paper trail, then at least that guarantees that the original computer vote or the count from it, you've got that backup. But now your article seems to indicate that there are huge problems. I know New York State was, I think, adopting a situation of computer voting with paper backup. So this seems to indicate that even the, quote, fixes of the first problems are now creating additional problems as well.
So far, yeah. I mean, definitely it would be possible to produce a machine that had a much more robust, high-quality paper attachment. The problem seems to be with this one is that from people that have looked at it and had to fix it, I talked to some technicians who were trying to fix them, they were broken on the day of the Cleveland election, that they're just simply not high enough quality. I mean, it's something that, from what I could see, it looks like something that's on the par of what you'd see at a local, you know, corner store cash register, basically. You could certainly make one that was much better quality, but they haven't been made that way.
Sarasota, 2006.
Now, in Sarasota, you had a very interesting situation. So you're down in Florida. It's a fight between Vern Buchanan, Republican, Christine Jennings, a Democrat, to replace Catherine Harris, a very famous, high-profile race.
Congressman,
that's right. And so it was a very, very closely fought race. It came to under 400 votes, which is incredibly tight. But When they did the recount, they found that there was an 18,000 undervote. Now, what that means, an undervote is when someone goes to the polls and there's 20 or 30 races and they vote in every race except for one. That's an undervote. And that's what happened in this case. People voted in every other race. 18,000 people voted in every other race except for that race. Statistically, it's completely off the scale. And a normal undervote is about 3 or 4%. This was an undervote of about 13%. So the question became, what caused that 10% difference? And Christine Jennings, who lost, has been mounting a case for 2 years, arguing that it was a machine malfunction, that people intended to vote for her, and the machines, for various reasons, maybe the screen was out of whack, maybe something went wrong with the software, maybe it's a bug that hasn't been disclosed, hasn't been found, and did not record votes for her, and that she lost because of the machine. She's still fighting that.
And there has been no resolution of what potentially could have even caused the problem?
No. And part of the problem is, and this is where things get really interesting, is that it's often very hard, because they're computers, to figure out what went wrong, or if anything went wrong. Because you'll have voters that'll walk out of the voting booth, and they'll say things like, I saw my vote flip in front of my eyes. Like, I touched one candidate's name, and I saw another candidate's name an inch below get highlighted. But the problem is, because you can't be there with them, you don't know whether it was their mistake or the machine's mistake, right? So similarly, when you have a very unusual result like this, an incredibly high undervote, you can never really figure out what happened, because you can never recreate those situations. And everyone who knows computers knows that computer code, when it gets really long and really complex, is just going to have a certain amount of bugs that need to be fixed, and that can unpredictably cause problems. Computers cause problems unpredictably and of unpredictable scale. They work fine 99% of the time, but the 1% of the time they stop working, you don't know whether it's going to be a tiny problem or a big problem.
Now, you mentioned also the one case of a small town where no votes appeared for the candidate for mayor, but he was sure that he at least had voted for himself.
Yes, exactly. 80-person town. The mayoral candidate went in and voted, and there was no votes recorded for him. He was pretty sure that he claims that 8 or 9 friends should have voted for him also.
This is in Waldenburg,
yes,
Arkansas.
That's right. But again, you see, this is the interesting thing, is was it his and his friend's mistake, or was it the machine's mistake? You can never really know. So the real problem with the machines is that they engender an enormous lack of trust. The losers have a lot of reasons to never accept the fact that they lost, because they can always point to a potential computer bug. They can't prove it, and their opponents can't prove that there wasn't a bug. So you wind up in this gray zone, which is almost like a custom made for legal battles. So what people worry about with the next election is that you're going to have a battleground state where there's a closely fought presidential race that tips the election. The odds are on Pennsylvania, because in Pennsylvania, you have about a little more than one-third of the people voting on the exact same machine that caused the problems in Sarasota.
And that machine is?
The Ivotronic by ESNS. It has no paper trail. It just has the chips. You have to trust what's in the chips. And it has this record of being involved in the controversial race. So essentially, the scenario that scares people is this. The presidential race comes down to a few thousand votes in Pennsylvania. 21 electoral college seats. It's a pretty big chunk of votes. And because it comes down to a few thousand votes, there's an automatic recount. And the loser, be they Republican or Democratic, discovers, as they probably will, that 10% of the machines displayed some form of aberrant behavior, crashes, glitches, complaints by voters that things flipped. So that will give them enough of a basis to just start a legal fight, saying, you know, I don't trust the results of this election. And that could wind up in the back of the Supreme Court.
Well, what about the whole issue of hacking into computers held by counties that actually count the vote? That was raised numerous times by citizen groups who have been following this and raising questions about the past two elections.
Yeah, it's true. For the first long while, I guess around the, you could say the early 2000s, all the concerns about election machines were about their vulnerabilities, about hacking. And it is true that every time a computer scientist has been able to examine the machines, which is difficult because they're considered a trade secret. The guts are considered a trade secret. You're not just allowed to ask for one and look at it. But in a few rare situations, either the code has been leaked or a state has decided to subject the machines to a review. They've discovered a lot of vulnerabilities, ways of introducing viruses that would swap votes, ways of hacking the machines just by guessing, fairly easy to guess passwords on the servers at tally votes. So the fact of the matter is, yes, there's a lot of evidence that you could hack and throw a vote if you wanted to. But the truth is, when you actually talk to the computer scientists who've studied this stuff and ask them, do you think anyone has ever done it? They say no. The likelihood is pretty small. What they're much more concerned about, and this is where it's interesting, is the everyday malfunctions that appear to be going on regularly 10% of the time. That's what scares them right now.
I'd like to ask you also about the human factor. And obviously, those of us who have been voting for years are familiar very much with going into a voting booth, and the people who are working there are inevitably elderly people who have been doing it for years, because most local governments don't pay very much to their election day volunteers. No. So the folks that are working these polls very often are people who, for whom the entire computer age revolution is something that they just haven't gotten into. And the question about the human factor in all of this.
Yeah, the human factor is a big deal, because you got to understand, running an election is like setting up an army that you deploy only a few days a year. And the volunteers have incredibly complex jobs. They have to be interpreting elections law, determining who can vote and who can't, in addition to running the machines. And every time the machines have been deployed, the first couple of elections have always had a lot of problems, because, again, you're precisely right. You've got a lot of senior citizens who have been working diligently for decades running elections, but they did it with paper machines, paper that they understood very well. Here along came machines that even when they worked perfectly, had a certain amount of errors that were a little baffling. In Cuyahoga County, they had an absolute catastrophe the first time they ran it in the 2006 primaries. The polls were open late in the evening. They lost dozens and dozens of the memory cards that had the votes on them. It took well into the next day to count them. They lost all sorts of equipment, security equipment, like stuff just went missing. So it's very, very hard to train people to run an election. It's even harder when you have very, very complex machinery.
Clive Thompson, explain now how states are dealing with this. I mean, it's amazing. It doesn't get a lot of attention. A state by state says they're getting rid of their Diebolds or whatever the machines they have are. What are we going to see in 2008?
Well, Diebold no longer even exists, right? They changed their name.
They changed their name to Premier Election Solutions. That's right. Diebold, the company, exists. The division that makes the voting machines is now called Premier Election Systems. What's going to happen in the next year? It's a really interesting question, because the fact of the matter is, over the last few years, all the concerns that were originally raised by citizens groups and by computer scientists that were originally sort of dismissed out of hand, i.e., that these machines are hackable or that they have unacceptable failure rates, those have risen to the point where now secretaries of state accept them. And they openly talk about stuff that I only heard computer geeks saying 8 years ago, like the fact that they think that the privatization of voting machinery is wrong, and that the systems ought to be open, that anyone can look at the software. This is absolutely remarkable. I've never seen a transition like this. And so what's happening is a bunch of states, one by one, have decided to get rid of the machines. The high-profile ones are Florida. After that fiasco in Sarasota, they just said, forget it. All the big counties that have these touchscreen machines, you're going back to paper.
So you're going back to Chad's?
Well, no, actually. They're going back to a paper system that's considered much more reliable. The problem with the hanging Chad's is that you were punching holes in paper. And that's actually a very weird thing to do. We don't do that on a day-to-day basis, so we don't know how to do it. And people would half punch a hole, and that was the hanging Chad. You get an argument over, did they intend to vote or not? What they vote on now is something much simpler. It's a paper ballot. With just like if you did a test in college where you're filling in dots, and anyone knows how to do that, and then you scan them. So you get the best of human ability with computer ability. The humans know how to do this very accurately, and the computers know how to count them very quickly. So, and if you have a recount, you just pull the paper out and look at the paper. And traditionally, there's not a whole lot of argument over voter intent in those situations.
So that's what Florida's doing.
That's what Florida's going back to, and that's what a lot of the states want to go back to. Other ones include California, decertified a whole bunch of machines. Colorado, just last month, decided that it was going to decertify a bunch of machines. And several other states are looking at it also. So the dominoes are sort of toppling.
But this whole issue of, as you alluded to, the privatization of this process, for many people, it's just astounding that such a central part of of our political process has been increasingly sort of turned over to these private firms to be able to do the not only the production of the machinery, but then actually the servicing of
it, right,
and so forth. Do you see any indication that that's going to change, that government is going to bring a lot of these processes back within government itself?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. There's sort of two parts of it. One is, do they want, are they worried about having lost control of this? And I think a lot of secretaries of state are, but some aren't. I mean, this is the thing about elections is that it's a completely local affair, right? So you've got some counties and some states that are like, this is fine. Other ones that are very concerned that what's happened with touchscreen machines is that they've bought machines that are of such high complexity that no one at the county level or the state level fully understands it. When things are broken, they have to hire the vendor who sold the machines to come in and fix it, and have to trust them to deal with them honestly. So the counties that do want to regain control can do so to a certain extent by going back to this paper-based balloting, simply because the recounts, because they're done just with looking at paper, they have a lot more control over. And the machines that scan them, they are computers, so they require some complexity, but they're just much, much less complex than touchscreen machines. So they can establish a fair amount more control over that. The interesting question is, can this be done in time for the 2008 election? Probably not, because the fact of the matter is that it takes a long time, 18 months at a minimum, to make a healthy switch over to a new system. There isn't enough time for all the states that want to switch over to do so. So by 2008 election, presidential election, probably one-third of the electorate will still be voting on touchscreen machines.
Do you know about what these voting machines were used in New Hampshire, LHS? What its record is, LHS having a exclusive programming contracts for all New Hampshire voting machines, and its record?
I confess I haven't done much research into that. I've read a little bit about it. It's paper-based balloting, so in the event of recounts, they do have paper to look at. The concern tends to be in these situations is the automatic counting on the scanning being futzed or hacked in some sort of way. It is possible with those scanning machines for there to be errors. It's possible for them to be hacked. But the point is, if you demand a legal recount, you go back to the paper and look at the paper.
The bill in the Senate that would ban all electronic voting machines by 2012?
Yeah, the Nelson bill. That's currently moving along. It's slow. It's very controversial because Nelson and several congressmen and senators would like to get rid of all these machines. They're worried by the error rate. They're worried by the hackability. But it's very expensive. It cost the federal government $4 billion to put all these touchscreen machines in place. And a lot of the counties do not want to have to be forced to go back to something new. And there's a question as to whether or not the Nelson bill will pay for it. If there's no money mandated for it, most of those counties will probably stick with it. And there'll be big fights over whether or not the federal government can force them to get rid of their machines.
Clive Thompson, thanks very much for joining us and writing the piece. It's called Can You Count on Voting Machines? It was the cover story of the New York Times Magazine this past Sunday. We will link to it at democracynow.org. When we come back, the candidates and climate change. Stay with us.
Ice is melting, polar bears are scrambling, the heat is all around. We've got to cool it down, cool it down. Appealing to the masses to cut our greenhouse gases down. Wacky weather here, stormy weather there, climate change is on us, the signs are everywhere. We've got to cool it down, cool it down.
Derek G. James. Cool it down here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
Several of the country's best-known TV journalists are coming under criticism for failing to question the presidential candidates about the crisis posed by global warming. A new study by the League of Conservation Voters found that the five major Sunday morning political shows asked the presidential candidates 2,075 questions in 2007. Just three of the questions mentioned global warming. Another 22 questions were related to global warming. In response, the League of Conservation Voters has launched the website whatarethewaitingfor.com and produced this short video piece.
Five top political reporters.
Wolf Blitzer.
Fox News and Washington
correspondent Bob Schieffer.
George Stephanopoulos.
Washington. This is Meet the Press with Ben Russell.
More than 120 interviews with presidential candidates.
Senator Hillary Clinton.
Senator McCain.
Mike Huckabee.
Barack Obama.
Senator John Edwards.
Rudy Giuliani.
Joins us from Santa Fe.
2,275 questions.
This is a serious question.
Senator McCain, you ever see a UFO?
Senator Gravel, Yankees, Red Sox.
Governor, we have a minute left, and I want to ask you about one other pressing question.
Senator Clinton, what about a World Series Yankees and Cubs?
That he had seen a UFO at Shirley MacLaine's home, and she says...
Which is run by Hugo Chavez.
That's a stretch.
Lost considerable amount of weight.
I have a yellow lab named Winston.
This is a serious question.
What were you thinking?
Did you see a UFO?
Global warming this morning, ironically, get this, it was canceled because of the winter.
Well, that's good to know. Perhaps Chuck Norris.
You have a very cool style.
Chuck Norris.
How much of that is tied to your race?
There is life beyond Earth. Do you agree?
Don't make me speak.
You're lucky to have Chuck Norris in your corner.
So on that note, diamonds and pearls.
Of the 2,275 questions, how many mention global warming? Only three. Meanwhile, the world's scientific community agrees that we're running out of time. If there's no action before 2012, that's too late. What we do in the next 2 to 3 years will determine our future. This is the defining moment. Go to whatarethewaitingfor.com and sign the petition. Tell the reporters to focus on the human race, not the horse race.
According to the League of Conservation Voters, Tim Russert of NBC's Meet the Press asked 755 questions to the candidates without mentioning global warming. George Stephanopoulos of ABC's This Week didn't mention those two words in any of his 726 questions to the candidates. Neither did Bob Schieffer of CBS's Face the Nation. According to the League of Conservation Voters, Wolf Blitzer of CNN and Chris Wallace of Fox News Sunday were alone in mentioning global warming. Blitzer mentioned it once, Wallace twice. Gene Karpinski joins is from Washington, president of the League of Conservation Voters. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here, Amy.
How did you do the counts? 2,275 questions on the five major Sunday talk shows.
That's right. And again, that was about a month ago. We're now over almost 2,700 questions with, unfortunately, the same result, which is only three questions mentioned global warming and 24 are global warming related. We literally sat down and read the transcripts of every Sunday morning talk show and every debate that one of these five TV journalists was associated with, and went through and looked for the words and looked for the related questions, and that's what we came up with. It was a painstaking process and a painful result, quite frankly, because the candidates, as you know, Amy, are talking about this issue every day. Many of them have made it a top priority, which is great news. It's the first time ever that many of the candidates have had aggressive, comprehensive plans to address the problem, and they're not just having it on their website. They're talking about it every day. But the embarrassing part and the sad part is that the leading TV journalists have failed to ask candidates questions to see how much it's a priority, to articulate the differences, to challenge the candidates how much this will be a priority. Those are the tough questions we need to be asked by the TV journalists rather than questions about baseball and UFOs and things like that.
I want to turn to the Republican debate in Iowa on December 12th. This is what happened when the moderator, Carolyn Washburn of the Des Moines Register, raised the issue of global warming.
I would like to see a show of hands. How many of you believe global climate change is a serious threat and caused by human activity?
I'm not doing hand shows today.
Yeah. No hand shows.
No hand shows.
I'm with
them.
And so, is that yes or no for you? Do you believe that global climate change is a serious threat and caused by human activity?
Do you want to give me a minute to answer that?
No, I don't.
I'm not going to answer it.
Okay.
About 30 seconds.
No, I want you to show hands.
I'm not
going to. We're going to follow up on that, but what I need to know is who believes global climate change is serious and caused by human activity, and then we'll talk in more detail about it.
I believe the climate change is real, and I've been involved.
I'm going to start with Senator McCain and come back to Mayor Giuliani.
I've been involved in this issue since the year 2000. I have had hearings. I've traveled the world. I know that climate change is real. But let me put it to you this way. Suppose that climate change is not real, and all we do is adopt green technologies, which our economy and our technology is perfectly capable of, and then all we've done is given our kids a cleaner world. But suppose they are wrong. Suppose they are wrong and climate change is real, and we've done nothing. What kind of a planet are we going to pass on to the next generation of Americans? It's real. We've got to address it. We can do it with technology, with cap and trade, with capitalist and free enterprise motivation, and I'm confident that we can pass on to our children and grandchildren a cleaner, better world.
That's the Republican debate. Gene Karpinski, the stance of the Republicans on climate change.
First of all, congratulations to that questioner from the Des Moines Register, because she did put the question to the candidate, and that's important. On the Republican side, clearly, John McCain stands head and shoulders above the other Republican candidates and is concerned about global warming. He's been a champion on this issue in the Senate for many years, and he's raised it as a top priority on the campaign trail. In fact, when you look at his win in New Hampshire on Tuesday, clearly that came from independent voters primarily. And Senator McCain, in his town hall meetings, he had over 100, regularly talked about global warming as a top priority. There were citizens at virtually all those events asking him questions about global warming. He talked about it. He's articulate about it. He shows he cares about it. And he made it clear it was a top priority. And that's very important. So kudos to the questioner and kudos to Senator McCain, in particular on the Republican side. The only other Republican candidate who's been willing to support a mandatory cap on emissions, which is what we need, is Governor Huckabee. He's not been as specific as Senator McCain. He's not talked about it as much on the campaign trail, but at least he's indicated support for mandatory increase in fuel economy and a mandatory cap on emissions. The rest of the Republican candidates, unfortunately, seem to be following the George Bush approach, which is, yes, we'll acknowledge there's a problem, but we're not going to do anything serious to address it, and that just won't work.
And what about the level of questioning in the overall debates? I know you haven't done the same kind of study, but there have been many debates on the issues of global warming to any, either Democratic or Republican candidates.
Sure. Well, the good news is that actually for the first time ever, there have been questions on global warming overall. We're now up to about 17, 18 questions that actually talk about global warming related issues. You know, the debate that had the most questions about global warming, interesting, was the Democratic debate hosted by YouTube, where you had the famous snowman. And there were three questions on global warming in that debate. So when the questions came from citizens, we had the most questions on the issue. So they have, and again, Charles Gibson on Saturday night in the Democratic debate asked a very direct, important question on global warming. We were quick to praise him, because that's the kind of conversation we need to have more often.
Let's go to that clip. ABC's Charles Gibson raising global warming during Saturday's debate in New Hampshire. His question was first directed to New Mexican Governor Bill Richardson.
Gore a few moments ago, reversing or slowing global warming is going to take sacrifice. I'm sort of sorry Chris Dodd isn't here, because he's talked a lot about a carbon tax in this election. Al Gore favors a carbon tax. None of you have favored a carbon tax. Is it a bad idea, or is it just so politically unpalatable that you guys don't want to propose it?
Can I answer? You know, I was energy secretary. It's a bad idea, because when you have a carbon tax, first of all, it's not a mandate. What you want is a mandate on polluters, on coal companies, on those that pollute to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by a certain target. Under my plan, 30% by the year 2020, 80% by the year 2040. It takes international leadership.
Senator Obama?
Well, I agree with Bill that I think a cap and trade system makes more sense. That's why I proposed it, because you can be very specific in terms of how we're going to reduce the greenhouse gases by a particular level. Now, what you have to do is you have to combine it with a 100% auction. In other words, every little bit of pollution that is sent up into the atmosphere, that polluter is getting charged for it. Not only does that ensure that they don't game the system, but you're also generating billions of dollars that can be invested in solar and wind and biodiesel.
What we've got to do is use energy as an opportunity to actually jumpstart economic recovery. We need to quickly move toward energy efficiency. We should require the utilities to begin to work for energy efficiency and conservation costs that will be shared and decrease the pressure on families. We need a weatherization and low-income heating emergency program that is out there now helping families in New Hampshire and elsewhere to cover their costs.
That was the Democratic debate Saturday in New Hampshire. Gene Karpinski, what about the Democratic candidates and their various stands on global warming?
Sure. A couple key points. And again, we recently released a voter guide, which you can see at www.lcv.org, which has all the candidates on a set of issues, but primarily focused on the issues of global warming and climate change, and the related issue of energy independence. Two key points about the Democrats. One is that they have now all articulated comprehensive, aggressive plans to deal with the problem. The most comprehensive, most aggressive plans we've ever seen, quite frankly, in a presidential race. In fact, if you take the specific issue of how much we need to reduce pollution, the scientists say we need to reduce it by 80% by 2050. A year ago, only one candidate was publicly on record on the Democratic side in favor of that. Now they all are. And that's because the citizens in the early voting states have regularly been asking the candidates where do they stand, and they've all now been very specific in an aggressive position of 80% pollution reduction by 2050. So that's the first good point. Second point is, it's not just a policy on their website or a speech they gave one day. Regularly, all the leading Democratic candidates make this issue a top priority that they talk about with the voters every day. And when they ask them what are their priorities, they always articulate this as one of the top issues, the related issues of energy and global warming. A couple points, Senator Obama mentioned 100% auction. That is, that rather than give away the rights to pollute, you auction those permits and therefore take the resources to use for good government purposes, to rebate to consumers, to promote green technologies. That idea wasn't on the screen of any of the presidential candidates a year ago, but now it's a key talking point. So a lot of good progress on the Democratic side, both in terms of having comprehensive, aggressive plans, but just as importantly, not just having it on a website on their campaign site, but much more importantly, having it as part of the conversation with voters every day.
But, that's important. But are there any?
The bottom line is, we need the next president who comes to the White House to come in with a mandate to make this a priority and to take action on day one.
But are there any significant differences that your organization notes among the Democrats?
Well, you know, a couple things over the course of the year. One is that we give credit to Senator Edwards for being the first out of the box back in March of last year with an aggressive, comprehensive plan. So he kind of really set the table and was the first out of the box with an aggressive plan. So, Governor Richardson, who actually I think is getting out of the race today, he actually has had the most aggressive timetables and goals in terms of how much pollution we need to reduce. But broadly speaking, they're all very aggressive. They're all very, very comprehensive. Those are a couple differences. But most importantly, they're all comprehensive and all aggressive.
You don't usually hear these candidates naming names like John Edwards talking about ExxonMobil, one of those powerful corporations in the world.
That's correct. And again, Senator Edwards has been very aggressive. He was the first to put a comprehensive plan on the table. He talks about it as a priority all the time. And he talks about what's going to be needed to be done to make a difference on this issue.
Finally, what do you think is the most important solution that no candidate is willing to endorse?
Well, you know, really, the most important solution is to do what the science tells us to do, which is a mandatory cap that requires pollution reductions of certain amounts by certain dates. And really, the Democratic candidates have gotten there. Senator McCain's comprehensive plan is comprehensive. His goals in terms of reductions are not quite as aggressive. So I think the key part that we need to see when someone gets in the White House is, will this be a leadership issue then as well? So far, again, we're very encouraged on the Republican side with Senator McCain and on the Democratic side with all the leading candidates that this is a priority. The biggest challenge and the biggest thing the voters need to continue to watch is to make sure this continues to be a key part of the conversation so that there's clearly a mandate so that on day one, this is a top priority.
Gene Karpinski,
that's what the world needs.
We want to thank you for being with us, President of the League of conservation voters. We'll link to his website. This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up, Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Rufo Belcondu, Sarah Monte, Angela Kamen, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Peter Curry, our engineers. Also, thanks to Becca Staley. On Friday night, Vermont, I'll be at the Mountaintop Film Festival in Waitsfield, Vermont, at 6 o'clock with Rick Rowley. Also, correction on the name of the song. It was Rafi's song, Cool It, the global warming song. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!